Hey, it's Bootstrapped Web. Jordan, you sound different.
Do I sound different, Brian? I got a new microphone. I've heard the complaints on Twitter about the echo. I'm here for you. I'm responsive for you.
Yes. Yeah.
Got a new microphone.
Sounds good.
Awesome.
What's up,
Brian?
Not much, you know. Getting ready for a quick family vacation next week. We're going down to the coast of Florida, get some beach time in. It was the fastest, easiest, quickest way to get to a beach from where I live. So we just booked that up and going to take the kids down there. And I don't know, maybe we'll try to venture our way over to Disney for a day, but mostly just sitting on a beach.
That sounds lovely. I was considering taking Monday off because I've been very, very stressed this week, but I screwed something up with my kid's passport. So instead, I'm going to get on a train, go to Seattle for the day on Monday, which is pretty much the same thing as going to the beach in Florida, just a little different. That's all.
Yeah, a little rainier.
Mm-hmm. A little rain. That's all.
Okay.
So, yeah, let's talk about this week. This week we had Rock and Jan, our CTO and lead engineer on the infrastructure side, in town in Portland for the week. We had an employee get married on Saturday last weekend, so we all went to the wedding. We all got dressed up and had a great time and went dancing. The whole deal. It was pretty awesome. So it was a wedding of one of the team members here, and there's just two full tables of Cardhook people with their significant others. It was cool. We had a great time. Yeah. And then the rest of the week, we did a bunch of road mapping and planning, and yeah, you can get into that. How about you, Brian?
Yeah, I guess a lot of like small updates. I mean, you know, main thing for me every day full time is working on Process Kit. I've been really enjoying that, really excited about it. I'm like coding full time right now on Process Kit. I made a lot of good progress on the designs. I think those are at a good place. So now over the past week, I've shifted out of working in Sketch, and now I'm working in Ruby on Rails code. I did start coding it last year, and then I put the project down for a couple months there, worked on Sunrise and everything. Now I'm back to Process Kit. So I was sort of like dusting off the code base and getting back into it and making some pretty good progress there. I'm hoping to like do more videos in the next few weeks of like working in public and showing progress on the app, like visually. So hopefully that'll be coming out, you know, doing some YouTube videos. Productize, the course is open now in March, for the whole month of March. I'm doing that a little bit differently this year. I could talk about that in terms of how I'm selling it. I got a couple things on audience ops I could talk about. We're hiring a writer. We're looking for somebody more technical, and I'm trying to reduce the distractions for myself in audience ops. Could talk about that. I guess back to Process Kit, I'm just thinking about like getting it into the hands of first users, hopefully sometime in the next couple of months. And I'm thinking through that whole process. So yeah, a lot of different things going on right now.
All right. The hiring theme, I feel like that's my next job, recruiting and hiring. It was less important, and now all of a sudden we want to move forward on things. We have 7 job openings.
Wow.
Yep.
That's crazy.
And it's a little crazy. So we're 18. We're going to go to 25. And it's just not that easy to find the right people.
Are they like all different departments, like developers, support?
3 on the tech and 4 in the customer side of things. 1 success, 1 sales, 1 technical support engineer. It's a bottleneck. It's not even, I don't even know what to describe it. It's like an impediment to your goals.
Yeah. I don't want to spend too much time on this, but just to mention it here on the podcast, I mean, hiring an audience ops for the right, like I've been trying not to hire anyone in audience ops for the past year, just really trying to keep the team size where it's at. And that's pretty much been the case for the last almost a year now. But we are at a point where we really do need another writer. Basically all of our writers are full, and it's kind of hard to take on new clients when our writing team is full. The thing that we're looking for now, like we have a couple of writers on the team who are a little bit more technical, like they have some experience with coding and programming or web applications or building software or the more technical side of marketing and things like that. So, or WordPress background, like really deep into the WordPress ecosystem. These are all areas that a lot of our clients cover in terms of their products. So we're trying to find a writer who is sort of experienced and knowledgeable in that stuff. And that's always like the hardest type of person to find, because they, you know, we only hire like really good writers, first of all. Like that's a given.
That's
so
hard.
So that's like we have a process where we'll just filter out like, you know, everyone except for like the top 3% writing quality. But then we look for people with certain backgrounds and experience and the ability to research subject matter and things like that. So I don't know, like if anybody happens to be listening and they're interested in something like that, you know, it's a freelance ongoing contract position, you know, audienceops.com/jobs. We've got an application form open over there. And the nice thing for me is that the whole hiring process in Audience Ops is basically off of my plate. Our team manager handles all of the reviewing of the applications and you know, doing the first interviews and everything and doing the test article process and all that. I sort of just hop in at the very end and take her recommendations and give the go ahead on who to bring on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good. And that's how we've done things for the most part. But I'm starting to understand that I still have a responsibility almost in the top of the funnel. The company being more visible and more recognized and press, it's just that stuff really, really helps. And it's the specialized roles. What you're talking about, it's pretty specialized. A great writer that does good research and is technical, that's tough to find. We have right now our most pressing need is for an e-commerce specialist. It's someone on the success team that knows e-commerce cold as well as our clients do. That's just tough. I don't even, you know, what we've been doing is we're thinking we need to go after e-commerce agencies. You know, people who are at agencies who aren't, you know, maybe they're bored or they're sick of doing a ton of client work and want to come in-house. Hiring is going to be a theme. I feel like that's my next job. Like, what's your, new title, new responsibilities. Yep, recruiting, hiring.
A couple of years ago in Audience Ops, I used to get so just like bogged down with the hiring process, especially during those like first two and a half years there where it was like we were hiring all the time, whether it's new writers, new managers, assistants. Like I was just constantly interviewing and sifting through applications and I hated it. So I'm glad that I'm basically out of that process now.
Yeah, I have taken more of a passive role in it. And then over the past few months, I have started to become more active in it. So I want a say. I said no at the last interview. What we've done so far is I basically do the last interview where it's like a, I don't even know what you want to call it, a sanity check or something. It's not really a sanity check. It's just like a culture check almost. And someone went all the way through in a bunch of interviews and I was the last interview and I said no for the first time. Because I just want more control over the vision of who I think fits in that role. One time I was hesitant. I mean, this is a little weird to say. And the person ended up being amazing. So it's like, you can be wrong too, but
it definitely. I mean, it never ceases to amaze me. Like when you look at applications and you do interviews and it's down to like two or three candidates and you usually have a sense of like, oh, this one is probably going to be the rock star. In my experience, it's almost always not that person, and the other person is almost always amazing. And
it's like credential fatigue. You get worn down by like, oh, you worked at this company and this company, you went to this school, then therefore it gets built up in your mind as like an asset.
Yeah, and I think people are really good at interviewing and applying, and there are aspects of working with the person that just do not come through in the interviewing and application process. Like no matter how you structure it, in my experience, there's been a lot of people who are super talented. Like you can't even question their talent, but their ability to show up every single day and not be a flake. And you know, that kind of stuff does not really come through until you work with them for a few weeks.
That's right. And the cultural fit and the friendliness and how the rest of the team reacts to them and how friendly, that actually ends up being 50% of it. Like the talent, you could learn a lot of this stuff. Maybe engineering's different though. Yeah, I talk about this regularly in the MicroConf like Portland crew. One of the guys who has a really successful business, he's been having trouble hiring. So we like went out to lunch and like swapped, you know, stories and whatever we could come up with, because we have been relatively successful at hiring here in Portland. We have a team of 9 people. And what we talked about was understanding the different levers you have, right? You have the salary lever, you have the cool office lever, You have the culture lever. You have equity. You have like all these levers you can pull and push. And the most important thing is to be aware of what you're doing. You can't not pay a high salary, have no office, and not give equity. You got to move those levers around. You got to say, okay, we don't have an office, but you can work remotely. Like that's a plus. And we're not giving equity because we're not looking to sell the company, but I'll give you a higher salary than you can get somewhere else. Just being honest about your company and how attractive it is and the offer it's making as a whole is what's necessary in order to close talented people and have them join. Everyone has these levers. Even like so Airbnb is in town, right? Airbnb is ridiculous. It's a mega $1 billion unicorn fantasy, amazing. They pay ridiculously well. They have an unbelievable office.
I mean, those big companies have to have like all the levers because they're competing against Google and Apple and Microsoft.
Yes. Now, what's your lever against them? That work is generally boring as hell and you make zero impact. So like you need to know that too. The hiring thing, I feel like we're going to talk a lot more about over the next year because it's just going to be the thing. I'm really curious to see what happens with Process Kit and
when I've talked about Process Kit to friends and people, and one of my goals right now is I'm starting up Process Kit, which is essentially a software company, and I'm doing different, you know, I did Sunrise, I'm doing Process Kit. So clearly I'm going in the direction of I want to build software products. And one of my big goals behind all that is stay as small as possible. Like, I am totally fine with being solo right now. Maybe working with a partner, if that were to arise, like I'm open to that idea still. But like, I'm really trying to avoid hiring anytime soon. Not that like I would never hire, and I certainly would expect at some point I would hire people. But like, I'm all for right now making the product and selling the product. And sometimes when I talk to people, they seem like instantly against that idea. I know that this is not for everyone, but like people sort of just like default to this notion that like if you're a business owner and you're the founder, you have no business coding, you have no business designing, you should not be doing those things. You need to be selling, you need to be talking to customers. And in my opinion, at least for me personally, I like talking to customers and I like coding and I like designing. And I like making the product inside and out, start to finish, and then selling it to people. Like, it's not this like one or the other. You know, you can't say to someone like me, and I know that there are others out there like me, okay, well, if you really like designing and coding, then you should just be a designer or a developer. Like, I have no interest in doing that for clients. I'm not going to go be a freelance coder, but I do like making things and then selling them to customers. Like it sounds so obvious, but like, anyway, there was just like a mini rant that's been like swirling around my head for the past year or two when I get feedback from people like, you know, this idea of like a full stack product person does not exist. I think that it does exist and there are people that it's fine, especially if you're bootstrapping, you know?
I think it depends on the nature of the product. That's what I think. Like in my head, I'm like March 1st, 11:09 a.m. Pacific, give it 2 years. Let's see what Brian's saying about this. And I think it depends on the nature of your product.
I got to be clear. Like I'm not like, see, this is another thing that people always sort of like misinterpret what I'm saying.
Okay, okay.
With this. Because I have this conversation with people again and again. 2 years from now, I don't expect to be solo. I expect to have a small team, like small, 5 people, maybe 7 people. But today, pre-revenue, pre-customers, solo founder, making the software product that I know the need inside and out, you know, I know the customers inside and out, I see nothing wrong with doing all the things to get it to a point to where it has customers. And then once it has customers and traction and growth, then I see like, all right, well, where are the pain points? Like, customer support is a pain point. I need somebody to take care of that. Or I should be doing that. And maybe I do need help at that point with hiring a developer or someone. But like to get to that point, I think there's nothing wrong with making all the things, you know?
Nothing wrong at all. It also extends your runway as long as possible. It gives you as much power as possible for when you're hiring, and that's all good. It reminds me of an engineer building version one or the foundational layer of a product and then hiring people to extend it. But when you have it in your head of what needs to get built, it's not a bad thing for you to build that foundation yourself. Yeah, I think what it is people should not be enamored with headcount. It's not just cool if you have more people. It's about the team you need in order to accomplish what your goals are. So right now, we need more people, not because it's cool, but because in order to accomplish the goals, we need more people. And we feel what's missing. But there's nothing wrong with going slower, not hiring, being small. I mean, the small thing, Nathan Berry tweeted out at some point over the past few days, if anyone knows software companies that are doing like $1 million per employee in revenue. What you're really saying is you want as much revenue per employee as possible. You don't care about headcount. You don't want to be, you know, master of 100 or 500 person company. You just want really profitable company with as small a team as possible that can accomplish it.
To me, I think about hiring in terms of like a software company. Like, I feel like my philosophy on it, at least today and probably for the next while, is hire when there's like an opportunity cost to not hiring right now. You know, and I don't feel that cost right now. People might look at it and say, well, if I were to just go hire a developer to build the version one of this thing instead of me doing it, then I guess I can go to market sooner. But that's going to cost a lot of cash and it'll probably take more time because I know all the ins and outs of how this product needs to work. You know, I feel like it would take longer to do that. And it's cash that I would rather save. And I have plenty of runway as it is with my other business funding all this. So it's not like I'm like running out of days in my runway here, you know? So I hear people like listening to the podcast or people I meet up with in person. And I have these conversations, I feel like again and again, where I guess I'll sort of like end this rant here, but it's just something that I'm hearing a lot. You know.
I think everyone should do whatever the hell they want in the beginning. There's no right or wrong. And then I think later on, it ends up being about the nature of the product, right? Like if you have, I mean, even that's an assumption, but still a to-do list app compared to what we have as a checkout, you generally will need fewer people per customer or fewer people per dollar revenue.
Right. The other interesting thing, this actually just came up. Did you see Josh Pickford's article about how they started this new thing from Barometrics and then they kind of shut it down after 3 months.
I saw that. Josh is the freaking man when it comes to just I don't even know, bravery, courage in exposing things and talking about things, the hard things, the ugly things, like that guy's my gold standard when it comes to that stuff. That sounded like a really difficult process from beginning to start, to build it and to shut it down. So good for him for kind of talking about it.
Yeah. I always applaud how public he's been with his stuff. But you know, what sort of comes to mind there is that, like, I feel like the idea of validating a product or validating a market is still so elusive, or it can be so deceiving to think that you have all this validation when you don't really, when you really, I feel like none of us really have validation until you have paying customers who are actively using it today. And that, I don't even mean like pre-sales, because I've been through that before and I've seen other apps go through pre-sales where people will pay ahead of time and then ultimately they still don't become paying customers. Mm-hmm. You know,
we're embarked in the middle of something now that we could have done more to get that buy-in. So it's still, what if we have paying customers, but we're launching a really big new feature for them that we spent a lot of time and energy on and effectively money on. But the validation still came from us believing that it's the right thing, as opposed to, I mean, we see what our customers are doing, but we don't know if they're going to switch over to our version of it. Yep. So we'll see. Yeah.
Which gets back to my point of like not spending a ton of money before we have revenue and paying customers. I'd rather spend my time because I have plenty of time. I have full-time hours to devote to whatever. Mm-hmm. And that's just ongoing. So
Yeah, I think that moves around. The calculation has different elements in the formula to get that calculation constantly. Like right now, you know, we've had months. I think we should be growing at 25K in MRR per month. When we do the right things, that's what we grow by. So that is now a factor in the formula. And so, like, to do the right thing and sometimes to spend the right money to get to a point where we're adding 25K in MRR is worth more. So I'm willing to spend more because I understand that that can be the result. So that, right. So spending $3,000 on a case study and $5,000 on Facebook ads is like totally rational.
Totally. And it's all about the phase of the journey that you're in, right? It's like when you're, again, like when you have traction, like that's when you want to start to dump cash and resources into, yeah, let's, you know, wrap it up.
So moves around.
How about distractions? You want to talk about that for a minute?
The distraction for my week has been the two execs in town. And I have been really focused on the value of them being here in person and road mapping. And I've let everything else go. And the amount of stress that piles up from just letting everything else go for 5 days or 6 days. Oh my God. It felt like my whole life was on fire. And I was like, everything's fine. That's over here. I want to focus on this because it's more important. And it's because you don't get that much done during the day, but it's really important work. But then at night, like they're here from Slovenia, you go out to dinner, you hang out, you don't stay in your house and do email. So it's really been like a week since I caught up and it feels like everything else is on fire. So for me, this week's distraction was a good, valuable distraction, but I have to claw my way out of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
How about you? What's distracting you?
Just audience apps. Well, what's distracting about it is that like I have so much free time from it every day, but then one day, maybe every 6 weeks or so, something pops up. All of a sudden, like that day, I don't have my usual free time, you know? And that's what's really frustrating, right? So
is it really a distraction or it's because it's unexpected? It's like very annoying.
It's unexpected and it's very annoying. And I'm so used to the daily freedom to work on Process Kit all day. I literally spend about 2 hours a week in general on average working on audience ops. So I have like full-time focus on Process Kit until, you know, a client issue comes up where it's like, it got through multiple layers of management that it got escalated to me where it's like, all right, this is something went wrong or some client has like an unusual website set up and we don't know how to publish articles to their blog because they insist on using Squarespace and some crazy setup. And so, you know, like that sort of thing frustrates me. I don't really know what I want to say about this other than, you know, when I think about building processes, because audience ops, you know, works so predictably on processes, there are still cases where you have these like edge cases. So it's like what to do when a customer's website is Squarespace instead of WordPress. And we've sort of worked out all these contingencies. Then you have like three or four different layers of that. Like, okay, they're on Squarespace and they're using an obscure email marketing tool, you know, and those two don't talk to each other. And like, so just little things like that, like, you know, I'm constantly, or like when this comes up, I have to go back and say like, how can this thing never happen again? You know, and go back and
never
figure out
bother
the policy, you know,
never bother me again about Squarespace.
Yeah. Yeah. So just the frustrating thing with audience ops is when it's these unexpected things, like I still do sales calls on audience ops and I sort of enjoy that. I like bringing new clients on board and then I pass their info to the team and they run with them. But then every now and then it's like these like technical issues. I don't know if we need to find like a technical manager or someone to sort of replace me when that happens. It happens so rarely that I feel hesitant to have to hire somebody for that. But when it does, it's just really annoying, especially when I'm sort of like in the zone on Process Kit. I wake up in the morning and I'm like, all right, today I'm going to ship this feature and that feature. And then by 2 PM, it's like, well, that didn't happen because, you know.
I don't know what you can do about it.
Yeah. I think today is turning into Brian ranting because he hasn't eaten lunch yet. But.
I love it. What is it? Yeah, 2:30. You haven't eaten. Not good. All right. Well, I had an interesting experience this week that I'd like to talk about. This week, for the first time, we considered acquiring another company. I think an acqui-hire would be more accurate. We came across a product that was being built And it was actually a Kickstarter for a software product, which was just interesting to see. But someone on the team, I think Ed, found it, pinged it in Slack, and something about it made my spidey sense like, wait a minute, what's this guy doing? Hold on a second. That sounds like I want to know more. So I got on a call with him and we talked through it. And then he actually came here to the Portland office, which was really nice coincidence because, you know, the tech execs were here with Rock and Jan. So the entire executive team got to meet with him directly in person here in Portland.
Wait. So just so I'm clear, like, how did it come up? Like, was it like, this is a business for sale and somebody on your team knew that it was, that the guy was trying to sell the business, or?
No, it was a Kickstarter for a software product related to Shopify. And the guy basically detailed out what he was building and, you know, was raising money to build it. Like, you know, here's what you get when you contribute. And, you know, I have my other projects.
So you guys sort of like approached him about acquiring before he started it.
Exactly right. I was like, so yeah, that was the conversation. So it was just very different to be in the shoes of the potential acquirer. That was new. And so I just learned things along the whole experience.
What made it attractive for you to try to?
My sense was that what he was building went along very nicely with our longer term roadmap. And it was an area of the roadmap that we had not started building. And so I thought to myself, well, this could be an opportunity to shortcut the building of that and bring in someone with expertise on that specifically. Right? Because right now what we do is, I have no idea how we're going to do X, but that's 6 months away. In 6 months, we'll figure out how to do it, which is normal for, you know, for development. But to bring someone in that has that expertise sounded attractive to me. So the whole way I learned lessons. So the first lesson in just wrapping your mind around being the potential acquirer is, oh, we have resources that I maybe don't always think about the fact that we have. We have three resources that we can use. We have salary, we have cash, and we have equity. So between those three, you can put together a package that is outsized compared to the size of your company, right? Because equity is it's very cheap in the short term and potentially very expensive in the long term. Salary, you're already hiring people. It's like not that different. Maybe it's higher or lower or whatever, but it's not that different. And then cash, we have some cash. So it's like a factor. It taught me we could actually do a lot more than I first thought in terms of
this. And to approach them so early in it, like the pre-launch, basically.
Exactly right. Because the day it launches, it's more expensive. Right. Yep. Let alone if it launches and has revenue or big customers or whatever else. That was an interesting lesson on like the finance side. And then the next lesson was in my team's reaction to my idea of acquiring this company and bringing this person on. And what I would say, this is not to be critical of anyone, I would say all of us played our expected roles to a T, like right on the money. Like CTO is like defensive, like, whoa, wait a minute, this is my tech, hold on a second. CEO is like, no, but what about the potential in the future? Product guy is like, well, I don't know if this what this does to our roadmap. Infrastructure guy is like, wait a minute, I don't know if this fits in with our existing infrastructure. So it was everyone. I had to try to articulate, like, we need to not approach it that way. We need to do like multiple things at the same time. We have to be unbiased from our point of view and look at this as an opportunity for the business that we're the executives. This is not about your role. Like your role is relatively safe, like, you know, the executive team, but we have to think about it for the business. Then you almost
They looking at it like, well, if we acquire, like it's taking over a product that it's just, I think the team is like, this feels complicated and it's going to make my job harder.
Yes. whatever it was, a lot of it was not like you don't even realize what your biases are. And so this helped bring all that out, like in an instant, you know, in one experience, in one conversation. And then what I had
and
to
it
do
actually
was,
goes back to the value, like the when you're hiring people to join Cardhook, a big part of the value, especially on the tech team, I would imagine, is like you get to play a part in building product from the ground up. A lot of them probably don't join. I guess today they do that. They're joining this established company, but like, I feel like one of the perks is like you will be part of the team making this, you know, from scratch.
Which is very true.
They didn't join Cardhook to like start working on other people's products, basically.
Yes. But it's still very true. Like everything's new. You're maintaining some stuff. So then what we had to do, once we had to say, wait, hold on, let's stop being biased, let's be unbiased. Then what I realized is we actually have to consciously be biased, but against ourselves. Like whatever position you had on it, like let's say your default position was no, we shouldn't do this. Now be completely biased toward yes, and like come up with the arguments for yes, so that you see the other side. You see the upside if your default position is no, or you see the downside if your default position is yes.
One reason why I would think about it twice is because I feel like if we went ahead and acquired this company, you know, we're acquiring them because they have some big piece of tech that we know or that we expected would be in our roadmap at some point. I feel like it would make me not want that acquisition cost to go to waste. And what if you learn things along the way? It's so early in your development process that like, what if you learn there's an easier, more efficient way to build that piece of tech, or you can work around it or whatever. Like having acquired that might cause you to stick to that path longer than you might have otherwise, you know?
Yes. And it also, it teaches you. We'd learned so much. So this person was super bright guy and was doing things in interesting ways that we're not doing them. And he's got a lot of experience on Shopify, and at least it opened our eyes to, oh, didn't actually realize that was possible. Didn't realize that type of customer views that way. So we learned a lot about the market too. I think we'll end up doing like an integration partnership at the end of the day. So it's like, okay, nothing really lost. The last thing that I learned was about the nature of my role as CEO, where I was arguing for yes, I want to do it. We then had a 2-hour in-person meeting and learned a lot more. And I started to understand like this is my decision, right? It has to be my decision. But everything's interconnected now. You're not isolated and just make a decision. Everyone just says, yes, sir. Well, whatever you'd like to do, sir, I'm with you. There's a lot of social capital that's built up over time, and it would have cost a lot of social capital in order to get my way. Yeah. Like, yeah, so yes, it's my decision, but that's not free.
It's such a long-term commitment, or
yes,
you know, seemingly at least.
Yeah. So it would have cost a lot. And then like the final piece of that is what I really realized that it's very easy to dismiss because you experience it every day. But what we have right now in terms of a momentum into the roadmap, into the plan, and lack of chaos, I guess I'd call it, that's really valuable. It feels like nothing because it's just kind of going about its business. But not disturbing that and allowing that to continue on is actually something that's really valuable. And ultimately, the decision was not made because we thought it was a terrible idea. The conclusion was, no, we shouldn't do it, because the positives did not outweigh what would happen internally between the social capital expended, the roadmap being disturbed, the general tranquility of the company being upended. It's like the positive didn't outweigh all of that, because that's actually really valuable right now. So it's just kind of made me view a lot of what we're currently in a very different way. So it ended up being a no, but it was huge lessons all over the place. It's cool. And now I'm walking around like a loaded gun. Maybe I'm sort of acquiring people. What the fuck?
Yep. Yeah, I mean, it's got to be a good it's good to go through that, whether you come out of it with the acquisition or not. I mean, to see it from that angle for the first time. That's awesome.
Now we'll see what happens with this product.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, I wish them luck.
Very cool. A quick one is Productize.
Yeah, what's going on? I saw the email from Productize. What did you open things up?
Yeah, so I opened it up I think I talked about this on the podcast. Last year in 2018, I had like an automated open cart, close cart system where literally every single week throughout the year, it would open for a batch of subscribers. And that worked fairly well. I think for the first half of the year, it definitely increased in sales from the previous year. And it sold throughout the year, but I think sales started to slow down as the year went on. You know, people feel a little bit differently about this. Some people are like, I was okay with the evergreen automated launch thing for the most part. But at some points, I was not totally okay with it. Every now and then, somebody would, actually pretty often, people would email me and say like, hey, when is the next time Productize is opening? You know, because they don't know that it's an evergreen automated launch. And I would usually say like, yeah, like it should be opening for you in the next couple of weeks. And sort of be vague about it. And I didn't love being not totally upfront about that. Or somebody would say like, I was gonna join when I saw that it opened last week, but I was away or I didn't have a chance. When's the next time you're gonna open it? And then I did have a way to like give them a special link where they could just go buy it now. So sometimes I would reply to them and say like, well, you could just go buy it now using this special link. And then sometimes they would and sometimes they wouldn't. And I don't know if that was sort of a turn off of like, oh, well, you could just have it open all the time. Anyway, so this year, especially when I switched over to ConvertKit, I couldn't do all the automation stuff that I was doing with Drip, but it was also sort of an opportunity for me to just simplify things and go back to, well, it's still closed all the time, but now I'm just going to open it a couple of times this year. And this month in March, starting today, March 1st, it is now open and I'm going to try it out this way. So I'm actually going to keep it open for the entire month of March and then close it again and do another opening later in the year and sort of just see how it goes this in terms of the whole year of sales to see what happens when I do like an opening maybe three times out of the whole year to see how that compares. So
you'll have more control of when it happens.
Yeah, yeah, I like it because like one of the cool features of it is that this thing called Mastermind Match, where people who join, I actually match them up into masterminds with other members so that they can have a weekly mastermind call among themselves. And so like now I have like a cohort that I can match them all up in batches for the March people and things like that. So, and then, you know, really my main focus though, aside from that, I mean, that's basically a passive thing that's going on with Productize, but with Process Kit, like I said, I'm back to coding it and working on it full time. I've been saying like I would like to have a version one like in the hands of users by May, so about two months or so from now, two to 3 months probably. But I mean, I think I might have something even sooner than that because I'm making a lot of progress pretty fast, and I've trimmed down the scope. So I'm starting to just in the back of my mind try to think about like how am I gonna roll this out. I got to start thinking about pricing because I still have no idea how I'm going to price it. And I'm a little bit bummed at the fact that I did take several months off of Process Kit for a variety of reasons I'm not going to get into here. But I'm seeing some of the effects of that. Like people are still emailing me and I'm getting early access requests and things like that. And I'm talking to customers again, but it's not as active as it was a few months ago. So I'm a little bit bummed that like, there's a large chunk of the early access list that is not as tuned in as they were a few months ago. So I'm trying to navigate that and get back to that. You know?
Yeah, you can regret it or you can just work from here forward to get them reengaged. I mean, yeah, you just do your thing. Take all that Sunrise KPI experience and bring it into this thing.
Yeah. One of the things that I like about it is that I'm getting, you know, because I hear people describe the pain points a lot. When I either talk to them or I receive emails and tweets from people. And like, one of the cool things about it is that like, I'm hearing the pain from both sides, the employees side and the founder or the employer side, right? Like, Like somebody just emailed me the other day saying like, you know, at this company that I used to work for, like I was an employee there, but like, man, I wish they had better processes and a system like this for us to use. You know, I've heard that many times. And then of course from the founders, it's like, I want my business to be more predictable and have better systems. And so it is a team tool. So I like that the pain is sort of resonating on both sides, you know?
Yeah. What I'm hearing is either a higher flat price or per seat pricing.
Yeah. And that's the thing that I keep having conversations about. It's like literally 50-50 with people saying, when I ask them, like, how do they feel about per user pricing? And some of them are like, well, I'm used to it. We already pay for like 8 seats for my agency. And that makes sense. And then others are like, I don't like it. I'd rather you just do it based on some other metric, whether it's like number of processes or features or something like that, you know?
If your vision is a smaller team that's highly profitable, the expansion revenue, the natural expansion revenue, I think we talked about this last time, like email marketing, like you just, the price goes up by default almost by the nature of it, that you add more email subscribers, that per seat pricing accomplishes that.
Yeah.
Because you keep your team small. It's even if it's the same number of customers every year, it expands on its own.
No doubt about that. I mean, this is something that we're going to have to get into in a future episode as I get closer to actually starting to sell it. But there's a lot of factors at play that I just don't know what I want to do with it yet, because there's competition who's doing free and doing per user, and some of them are and some of them aren't, and it's
not weird. Easy pricing. Yeah. All right, brother, we can end it off by the words of our friend Patrick McKenzie: charge more, Brian, charge more.
Yep, always a good idea.
All right, have a great weekend. Thanks for listening, everybody. Hope you liked the new mic.
Yeah.